Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
In the past 30 years alone, more than 2,800 innocent American prisoners, their combined sentences surpassing 25,000 years, have been exonerated and freed after being condemned for crimes they did not commit. Terrifyingly, this number represents only a fraction of the actual number of persons wrongfully accused and convicted over the same period. Renowned criminal defense and civil rights attorney David Rudolph has spent decades defending the wrongfully accused. In American Injustice, he draws from his years of experience in the American criminal legal system to shed light on the misconduct that exists at all levels of law enforcement and the tragic consequences that follow in its wake. Tracing these themes through the lens of some of his most important cases, including new details from the Michael Peterson trial made famous in The Staircase, Rudolph takes the reader inside crime scenes to examine forensic evidence left by perpetrators, revisits unsolved murders to detail how and why the true culprits were never prosecuted, reveals how confirmation bias leads police and prosecutors to employ tactics that make wrongful arrests and prosecutions more likely, and exposes how poverty and racism fundamentally distort the system. In American Injustice, Rudolph gives a voice to those who have been the victim of wrongful accusations and shows in the starkest terms the human impact of legal wrongdoing. Effortlessly blending gripping true crime reporting and searing observations on civil rights in America, American Injustice takes readers behind the scenes of a justice system in desperate need of reform. The book that we're featuring this evening is American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System, with my special guest, civil rights attorney and author, David S. Rudolph. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, David Rudolph.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate being on.
Thank you so much. Congratulations on this book, American Injustice, by the way.
I appreciate that.
Let's talk about a little bit about what this book is really about, what you are exploring in this book. But first, let's talk about some of the changes that you chronicle in the 60s and the 70s, and you call the Warren Court, that made some of these rights that we take for granted now their origins. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Dan, because I think all of us, me included, over the course of my career, sort of became inured to the fact that we have these rights. So, you know, the right to counsel, for one. You know, I always just assumed that that was something that was fundamental in our system. Similarly, things like, you know, the right to be warned that you don't have to make a statement. Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. All of these rights that I think we all sort of take for granted now did not exist really prior to the 1940s or 1950s. And it was really the Warren Court. You know, Earl Warren was a Republican. He was appointed by President Eisenhower. And it was his court that included some giants that set the course for civil rights and criminal justice rights in the United States. And all of those rights really began to be formed in the 1960s. And they're really new rights in a sense. You know, they're only 50 or 60 years old and therefore they're, you know, perhaps fragile. Vulnerable. And as we see with Roe versus Wade, for example, the fact that we have those rights now does not mean that they're there forever.
Tell us a little bit about your own decision when you left law school. Tell us where you got that degree, but tell us what your decision was and why after leaving law school.
Well, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And so, you know, when I was in college, Kent State happened. You know, you had all the uproar about the Vietnam War and then Kent State and students being shot to death on their college campus for protesting. And that had a dramatic impact on me. And then, you know, in the 70s, I was in law school and Watergate happened and the Attorney General of the United States was prosecuted and convicted of obstruction of justice.
Right.
And so I think all of those helped to form my skepticism, if you will, of government. And so when it came time to graduate from law school, I was interested in trying to help people. I really wasn't interested in money particularly. Money's never really been a large motivator for me. And it was just sort of a natural evolution for me to want to go and represent people and protect them against what I saw as the sometime arbitrary exercise of power by the government. And so that's what I did. I went to work for the Legal Aid Society in the South Bronx in the Criminal Defense Division. I was on 161st Street and 3rd Avenue in the Bronx, the heart of Fort Apache. And it was a great experience for me. You know, Barry Sheck was my roommate, along with about five other people. We were in a big office, one phone that we passed around among us. And and it was a time of pushing back against, you know, the forces that were sometimes abusing people in that community. And that was very formative for me.
You write about the misconduct and abuses of power by police and prosecutors, and that's what some of these stories definitely demonstrate and illustrate. You talk about a person named Ray Finch, and you first met him in 2013. Tell us a little bit about this meeting and why, and about a little more about the Ray Finch debacle.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in some ways, and this is sort of set forth in the book, Ray's journey through life and my journey sort of paralleled each other in some ways. You know, in the 60s and 70s, Ray was growing up in a small rural county in North Carolina, while I was growing up in a suburban community on Long Island in New York. And so our paths were very different. And what I try to do during the book is sort of contrast and compare where he was at certain points in his life with where I was at the same time in my life. But then our paths sort of came together in 2013 when Ray was being represented by the Duke Innocence Project. And they asked me to help them conduct a hearing to show that he had been wrongfully convicted. And I did that. And unfortunately, we lost that hearing. But the Duke Innocence Project persevered. They appealed that. And eventually, in 2018, they prevailed. And the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Ray's conviction, freed him. The prosecutor declined to pursue the case anymore. And then most recently, the governor of North Carolina pardoned Ray. He gave him a pardon of innocence.
Right.
But Ray ended up spending 42 years of his life from the age of 40 to the age of 82 in prison for a murder that he did not commit and for which I have to say he was framed. And he was framed to protect law enforcement in Wilson County, North Carolina. He fought for his innocence for the entire time. He got out, you know, after 42 years. And then yesterday he passed away.
Incredible.
And never really got to enjoy any portion of his life after the age of 40. And it's a sad, sad story, but it's also a very important story for people to understand how these things happen.
You talk about prosecutors and judges showing remarkable hostility to overturning new scientific evidence or proof of misconduct by police or prosecutors. Just tell us, I mean, we could spend a whole hour on this, but how on earth did he spend 42 years in prison?
Well, first of all, when he first started challenging his conviction, the judge who was ruling on his motions was the prosecutor who had prosecuted him.
Incredible.
So, you know, here he is. He's filing these motions for appropriate relief, challenging his conviction, and they're being denied by the same person who prosecuted him 5 or 6 years earlier. Then when the sheriff in that county was convicted for operating his sheriff's department as a racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization by the federal government,
right,
he again asked for the State Bureau of Investigation to come in and investigate and explain that his conviction was the result of those people trying to protect themselves because the real perpetrator knew about their corruption. The State Bureau of Investigation, I think, in my view, conducted a cover-up. And so he remained in prison after that. And then, you know, of course, it's very difficult for anybody in prison to get a lawyer to actually represent them. And when you're representing yourself, you're at great disadvantage, obviously.
Right.
Finally, in 2001, the Duke Innocence Project took him on as one of their first cases. But even then, the State Bureau of Investigation claimed that they couldn't find evidence that was critical to his being exonerated. And it took him another 13 years, took Duke Innocence Project 13 years to finally get the evidence that was relied upon to overturn his conviction. During the hearing that I helped him with, the judge, after hearing some really dramatic evidence, decided to recuse himself because he had represented people during the course of that corruption inquiry. That put everything on hold. A new judge was appointed. He denied the petition, and it took us another 8 years, essentially, to get him out. So it's the nature of the system, and in large part, it's because finality in our system of justice and the importance of finality trumps justice and truth, and I think that's a real problem in our review of these cases.
You say that something that's well known, but only defense attorneys discuss concerning the death of trials. You say it more eloquently. Tell us what your idea about this.
Well, and it's not my idea. You know, this is not anything that I've invented or labeled. And it's really it's known among us defense lawyers as the trial penalty. And, you know, back in the day when I first started, there wasn't much of a penalty for someone exercising their right to trial as opposed to pleading guilty. I can remember when I was starting out, And I would tell people, listen, you know, you can go to trial, but if you lose, the judge is going to understand that you caused the exercise of resources. If you are guilty and you plead guilty, the judge is likely to take that into account when he sentences you. But that's the best you could say. And right. Prosecutors back then, at least in the federal system, took no position on sentencing. Their view was sentencing is up to the court. They're there to present the facts, and then the court decides on sentence. Over the last really 30 years, since 1987, when Senator Kennedy introduced legislation to create the United States Sentencing Commission with the hope that that would equalize sentencing across the United States, what it in fact did was made the system draconian. And so now, first of all, prosecutors are in complete control of the charging decisions, but they're also in complete control of the sentencing options. So, you know, if you are indicted for a certain crime and you have to plead guilty to that or you're convicted of that, the sentencing guidelines create enormous penalties. Whereas if a prosecutor agrees as a result of plea bargaining or your cooperation with the government to indict you for a lesser charge, then that controls the penalty and it's a much less onerous penalty. So what does that set up? It sets up a circumstance where the prosecutors, who are your adversaries in this system, are in total control of the mechanism of both charging and sentencing. The judges are limited to a certain extent by the sentencing guidelines that are in place. And so what the charge is, what you're indicted for, what you're convicted for, that has a direct impact on your sentencing. And so what does that mean? It means that when I talk to a client now, I say to him, listen, they're offering you a plea to a conspiracy. And the maximum on that conspiracy is 5 years. That's the most you can do. But if we go to trial and they're charging you with money laundering and bank fraud and all kinds of other things, now the penalties are up in the 20, 30, 40, 50 year range.
Right, right.
So what is the average person going to do, regardless of whether he's guilty or not? He's not going to risk 50 years in federal prison when he can walk out after 3 or 4 or 5. So it creates an enormous penalty. You can't go to trial anymore without taking an enormous risk. And that means that plea bargains become the currency of the system, much more than they ever were before. And so it's an enormous problem for those of us who are trying to be advocates as opposed to greasing the wheels of the federal criminal justice system.
People talk about, and you discuss this, about false confessions. Again, how possibly anyone could agree and confess the crimes that they didn't commit. You have some shocking examples of how that can happen. Tell us about this phenomena.
Well, you know, all of us, I think in our early days, well, no, I would never confess to something I didn't do.
Right.
Or I would never plead guilty to something I didn't do.
Sure.
And I understand that. That's an understandable feeling. But what you have to do is put yourself in the place of a particular person. And let me give you an example. In the book, we discuss an example of a young man from Detroit who moved to a rural county in North Carolina and was wrongfully accused of murder. And the police put enormous pressure on his co-defendants in the way that I just described to cooperate against him and each other, sort of like the Central Park Five case.
Right.
All of these people started making statements against each other. This young man absolutely insisted on his innocence, and he refused to make any statements incriminating himself or anyone else, despite the pressure. But now he's sitting in all of his co-defendants have pled. They've all agreed to testify against him. He's sitting in a jail in a rural county, a black man in a white county, who is facing an all-white jury. All of his co-defendants are going to testify against him. He's 21 years old. He has a two-year-old daughter in Detroit, and they offer him a plea to manslaughter with a maximum sentence of 10 years. And he's told that if he doesn't take that, they're going to try him for first-degree murder. He'll be facing the death penalty, and he'll be facing it in a county with an all-white jury, and he's a young Black guy from Detroit in a rural North Carolina county.
Sure.
So, you know, what does he do? He doesn't, you know, flip on these other people. He says, I'm going to plead guilty, because he cannot risk the possibility of being sentenced to death.
Right.
So is it surprising that he would enter a plea of guilty, even though he completely insisted on his innocence? No. We flash forward 10 years. And in North Carolina, there's something called the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission that reviews cases like his on request. And they unanimously find, three judges of the North Carolina Superior Court unanimously find, despite his plea of guilty, that he's absolutely innocent and he is exonerated. So there's no doubt that he pled guilty to something he didn't do, because of the pressures that were exerted on him. I'll give you a less dramatic example. Somebody is arrested for a misdemeanor, and his bond is set at $1,000, which he can't make. And he sits in jail for a week, a month, 2 months, 3 months. He loses his job. His apartment is at risk. His custody of his children is at risk.
Right.
He has no control of when his case is going to be called for trial. And his lawyer comes to him and says, listen, the prosecutor is offering you a deal. If you plead guilty, he'll agree to time served. In other words, plead guilty and it's a get out of jail free card. On the other hand, if you want to insist on your trial, we don't know when we're going to get to that. And you're going to sit in prison on $1,000 bond or jail. So what does the person do in that circumstance? You know, the choice is really not a choice. And so those are the kinds of pressures that are brought to bear on people every single day in our system.
You talk about a confirmation bias, and we've heard about that. But tell us how that works in the case that you chronicle in your book with Ed Friedland and the murder of his wife.
Well, you know, and that's a good example, Dan, because Ed was a prominent doctor. He wasn't a marginal citizen. He wasn't a drug addict. He had no criminal record. He was a good Jewish boy from New York who moved to the South with his wife and established a very successful medical practice. And he had an absolute alibi on the day his wife was murdered. He was at the hospital in Charlotte, North Carolina, all day that day.
Right.
You know, every moment of his time was accounted for. And his wife was brutally, brutally murdered. And the police began their investigation by focusing on a handyman who had worked at his house, who had a criminal record, and who his wife's friend said, you know, we think this is the guy who did it. He was just acting suspiciously around the house. And the police had all kinds of evidence that this guy was in and around the neighborhood that night, acting suspiciously. So it was really a pretty strong circumstantial case against this fellow. And then the police found out that Ed Friedland had had an affair with a nurse.
Right.
And everything changed. At that point, it was, aha, he's the guy. He did this because of the affair. And then, of course, the police decided, you know, he really wasn't acting right when we came upon the scene. You know, he hadn't rushed over to the body the way we would expect a husband to rush over to the body.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't hysterically crying the way we would expect a husband to be crying. You know, they didn't bother to consider whether he might be in shock.
Sure.
And that the fact that people react differently to situations is sort of well known. So all of a sudden, this narrative began to form. And the investigation went on for 4 years. And the district attorney kept saying, no, we don't have enough to indict him. You know, he has this alibi. How are we going to indict him? And so the police decided, well, we need to establish that his wife died before he left for the hospital. So they got a hold of a well-known pathologist who agreed out of state, you know, first time ever that they went outside of North Carolina to a New York pathologist, medical examiner, and got this fellow to say that in his opinion, that time of death was prior to 8 a.m. in the morning. And based on that, they got an indictment. I represented Ed, and I was fortunate enough to be able to find the expert who undermined this doctor's opinion, this medical examiner's opinion. But more importantly, the police had taped an interview with this expert. And in that tape, they clearly sort of fed him facts. And he said, I don't really think I can give you what you need. This was before he agreed to help them. And they had turned that tape over in a DUI case because they were giving the public defender the DUI call-ins. And what they didn't realize was they hadn't erased the prior discussion. And so I got a hold of that tape. The public defender realized what it was, called me, gave me the tape. And so now I could totally undermine that medical examiner's testimony.
Right.
And then we were able to get, because the judge ordered it, all of the evidence that the police had hidden from the prosecutor about this handyman.
Wow.
That the prosecutor had never heard of. And at that point, after 4 years of being under suspicion and a year of being under indictment, the charges were dismissed. So that's a really good example of how tunnel vision, how confirmation bias can take the police away from where they should have been focusing and onto a totally innocent person. And the result of that, by the way, is that that handyman was never charged with her murder. And 3 or 4 years later, he ended up killing another woman.
You talk about this exculpatory evidence, and you also talk about why that's dangerous for that to be held back. And so this is another example of that as well. So tell us a little bit about the concealing of evidence of a defendant's innocence and how it came to be that prosecutors gained immunity for that. You say police don't have immunity, but how did it come that they obtain immunity?
Well, police have partial immunity. Police have what's called good faith immunity. So when the police engage in some unconstitutional conduct, you have to show that they did it at minimum with reckless disregard for the rights of the person that they were investigating. If you can't show that, if all you can show is mere negligence, for example, they have immunity. And that's called good faith immunity. Prosecutors, on the other hand, have absolute immunity for their prosecutorial decision. So, for example, if a prosecutor hates me and decides he's going to indict me because he hates me and makes up all the evidence and brings it to a grand jury and they indict me and I can prove that and the charges are dismissed, I have no cause of action against that prosecutor. He has absolute immunity. What's the theory? And that's created by the Supreme Court. That it's purely a judicial creation. Why? What's the rationale for that? Well, prosecutors have to exercise their discretion without fear of being sued. And so we have to give them absolute immunity so that they can make decisions without any fear. And in theory, that's probably a reasonable position. But in practice, it has led to a complete abdication of their role in screening cases and in weeding out the weak cases from the strong cases, because they have nothing to fear. And that's a real problem.
Let's use this as an opportunity, David, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. Whenever I want to get away from the True Murder podcast and reading authors' books to prepare, I play Best Fiends. It's a great distraction, especially when I'm on a little winning streak or playing an event. I'm at level 550 right now, and I love the most how engrossing and entertaining Best Fiends is. It's something just for me. There's so many cool characters. I play to unwind a bit, but it's an escape to an entertaining world every time. I'm obsessed with playing Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a mobile puzzle game that everyone can download and play. No matter how much time you have, Best Fiends is the perfect puzzle game to lose yourself in. The game features numerous fascinating characters that assist you to solve what are thousands of fun puzzles. And the more you play, the more characters you collect, and the more you win, the more challenges you face. New characters and challenging puzzles are constantly added, and there are always many events where you can win big rewards. There are thousands of levels. You never will get bored. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's Friends Without the R, Best Fiends. Now, we talked about how some of these things could happen, employing certain things, and you get to fabricating or planting evidence for implicating a suspect in a crime. Again, we just talked about the immunity that absolute immunity that prosecutors have. Tell us how fabricating evidence came into play in the Michael Peterson case.
Well, for those of you who watched The Staircase, you may remember an expert witness by the name of Dwayne Deaver, who was a blood spatter expert. In that case, Mr. Deaver testified about what he claimed he could tell from the blood evidence at the scene. In fact, he was committing perjury, as the judge subsequently found 8 years later. But, you know, what happened in that case was that the police really didn't have any evidence against Michael. You know, they had, you know, some character assassination evidence that he was bisexual. They had some circumstantial evidence that the wife of a friend couple of his and his former wife's had been found dead of, at that point, a cerebral hemorrhage at the foot of a set of stairs, which is where his wife, Kathleen, had been found. And that was it. They had no motive. Everybody said the couple got along terrifically. There was nothing. And so they needed evidence because they were convinced that Michael had committed this crime. And so here comes Dwayne Deaver. He works for the State Bureau of Investigation. He's called in to help the detective prove his case. It's in precisely this situation where there is a paucity of evidence against the suspect that the possibility of fabrication or planting of evidence is most problematical, because the police are convinced they're right. They don't want to see this person escape his just punishment. So we need to sort of create some evidence that'll make sure that that justice is served. And so it's become known as noble cause corruption. It's really a fancy way of saying the ends justify the means.
Right.
The ends being, let's convict this person because he's guilty. And the means are, let's fabricate some evidence to make sure that happens. And that's what happened, in my judgment, in the Peterson case. And it happens all the time in cases, particularly where the evidence is weak, as it normally is when, guess what, the person's actually innocent.
You write about resorting to highly unreliable forensic disciplines, and to many people's surprise, that would include many things that we think and the courts have regarded as ironclad. Tell us about some of these things and the dramatic example of how you can't trust fingerprint analysis.
Well, you know, fingerprint was always sort of the gold standard before a DNA. And when I was a young lawyer, I was told that, you know, if you had 7 or 8 or 9 points of comparison that matched, that was it. No two fingerprints were ever, you know, the same. And that was the end of the case. Well, some years ago, there was a train bombing in Madrid, Spain. And, fingerprints are ubiquitous on the web. And so they lifted some fingerprints from a timer And lo and behold, it came back to match a lawyer in Portland, Oregon, who was an American, but who had become a Muslim, had married a Muslim woman. You know, the fingerprints were identified as being his. And so all of a sudden, you know, he's being declared at first a material witness, and then he's clearly a suspect, and he's about to be railroaded on this until the Spanish authorities figure out that the fingerprints actually match someone who was on their watch list as a terrorist or a potential terrorist. And they go back to the FBI and say to the FBI, no, we think you're wrong. And, you know, the FBI is quite sure of themselves. And of course, confirmation bias is kicking in here because this lawyer, although he's an American in Portland, Oregon, and has never been to Spain, you know, is a Muslim. He's a practicing Islam.
Sure.
And his wife is. And so, you know, obviously, that's another piece of the puzzle. So, you know, and the end of the story is that the FBI finally agreed that no, the fingerprints didn't match this guy. And probably what had happened was that the fingerprints were sort of close enough, you know, for government work. Then the fact that this fella had these other suspicious so-called associations pushed it over the edge. And again, it's one of those situations where confirmation bias and tunnel vision ultimately causes wrongful accusations and convictions. It's not that the FBI was trying to, you know, set up or falsify evidence against this lawyer. It was that it was close and then confirmation bias kicked in.
You also talk about, you call it pattern-based testimony. So we're still talking about some of these forensic disciplines that are utilized in court and have been utilized in court that you say that have led to some dramatic wrongful convictions. Tell us a little bit about some of the other disciplines that are in question and why.
Yeah, and it's not just me. I mean, in 2009, the National Institute of Science did a report on forensic sciences, and they pointed out that a lot of these so-called forensic sciences are really not sciences at all. So let me give you some examples. Let's take tire tracks, tool marks, handwriting, anything that involves a pattern where there is no objective way of validating the opinion.
Right.
Where there is no way of recreating the opinion, where there's no validity testing of the expertise of the alleged person who's reaching the opinions. In contrast, for example, to blood typing or to DNA analysis,
right,
where you know you have standards, other people can review the results are uniform and can be verified and duplicated. You don't have that with these pattern pieces of evidence. You know, a blood spatter is another example. All of these sort of pseudosciences have somehow become accepted by the courts because people get up and say, this is my experience and this is why I think they match. Here's another example.
Right.
So there's no way of validating what the findings are. The way they're validated is if the jury convicted the person, well, that shows that that the science was right. And that's exactly the wrong way of validating.
You also talk about incentivized witnesses, and that seems obvious why that would present a problem, but you chronicle cases in your book, dramatic cases where they resorted and referred to these incredible jailhouse snitches for their source of information.
Well, and imagine, Dan, imagine a defense lawyer who went to a witness and said, you know what, if you'll testify that my client was actually with you at a party, I'll pay you $10,000. You know, if that ever happened, that lawyer would be indicted before you could snap your fingers for obstructing justice. Yet prosecutors every day in this country go to witnesses and offer them years off their sentences in return for their testimony implicating cellmates or people they know. And for the life of me, I don't see any connection between those two things. Yet it's accepted and sort of celebrated that's how you get convictions. So, you know, what you have is you have witnesses who are trying to work off their own problems or they're trying to earn money as a result of rewards. And prosecutors routinely use these people, and they are responsible for a large number of wrongful convictions, as you would expect. What you shouldn't expect is that the system would authorize that kind of behavior.
You have exonerations based on DNA evidence, but how prevalent is DNA and how relevant is it in most cases, as you write?
Well, you know, the problem is that DNA evidence is not present in the great majority of cases. You know, it's present in sex cases often. It may be present in murder cases, but it may not be. And when it's present and when it's used properly, it's a very precise and important and reliable tool. And it has convicted people. And as you point out, it has exonerated people. But where you don't have DNA, which is the vast majority of cases, you have to rely on investigation and turning up defects in what the prosecutor or the police did. Because the mere fact that you can prove your client is innocent is not a ground for overturning their conviction.
Wow.
I can introduce.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Tons of evidence that my client is innocent. But unless I can point to some defect, some procedural defect in the prosecution, you know, the failure to turn over exculpatory evidence, the creation of a fabricated confession, unless I, you know, the use of an unlawful search, unless I can point to some other defect in the prosecution, the mere fact that I'm coming in after the fact and I'm saying, listen, they've got it wrong. Here's all the evidence. Here's the DNA evidence. Here it is. He's excluded. That's not enough, because finality in our system trumps truth and justice. And that is a shocking fact that most people just don't realize.
Let's use this as an opportunity, David, to stop for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you talk about all of the times that people are innocently convicted or are wrongfully convicted. Pardon me. What are some of the reforms that you would like to see that would amend this, that would correct this injustice?
Well, you know, let me just start by saying I don't think you can eliminate it because the system is, you know, run by human beings and human beings make mistakes. So the goal needs to be to minimize the occasions where that happens. So let's talk, for example, about airplane crashes or about medical mistakes or errors that cause, you know, catastrophic injuries or deaths. In those situations, what you have, generally speaking, is something called a sentinel event review. And what that is, you know, the experts get together, the doctors, the other experts, or the mechanics, the plane engineers, and they get together. And the purpose is not to assign blame. The purpose is to understand what happened, why it happened, and how to prevent it from happening again. That's it. And every time there's a plane crash, the National Transportation Safety Board comes in. It doesn't matter how many people are killed or injured. It could be a solo plane crash where the person walks away. But NTSB comes in and does a sentinel event review. Same thing with medical negligence cases. But yet, when somebody spends 42 years in prison like Ray Finch did and is then exonerated and pardoned by the governor of North Carolina, there is nothing that happens to review what happened, why it happened, and how we can prevent that from happening again. So that's the first thing that I think needs to be addressed, is making sure that we don't just rely on, you know, money damages to deter this in the future, right, that we actually spend the time and the resources necessary to really understand this and then to try to prevent it. How do you prevent it? I think that to the extent you can, it's a matter of training and selection of officers. So, you know, for one thing, you know, we need to make sure that police officers are being screened to make sure that their personalities and abilities are appropriate for the tasks they're being asked to perform. And then we need to train them, just like we train doctors in confirmation bias, by requiring them to make what's called a differential diagnosis, where they have to work their way through various possibilities and rule those out before they come to a final diagnosis. The whole purpose of that, obviously, or one of the major purposes, is to address confirmation bias. And so we need to do the same thing with detectives. They need to understand that when they're investigating a case, what they should be doing is not just trying to prove that somebody did it, but trying to prove that other people didn't do it. You know, that the other possibilities are not accurate. And so that would go a long way. And then, you know, I think that detectives in particular and prosecutors and judges need to be trained in confirmation bias and what that is and the fact it exists for all of us. Because until and unless you're aware of the issue, then you're going to be subject to it. Once you're aware of the issue, it doesn't mean you're not going to be subject to it. But what it does mean is that you're aware of it and you can try to control it because you're aware of it.
How much is poverty a factor that can't be undone by some of these reforms?
Well, you know, poverty and racism and all the other ills that afflict our society and many others are reality. The best you can do in those circumstances, I think, is to try to level the playing field as much as possible. So, for example, we need to do more to fund public defenders. You know, in many places in this country, public defenders have caseloads of 75, 100, 150 cases at a time.
Wow.
They don't have the resources to prepare those cases. They don't have the resources to hire experts, whereas the states generally have unlimited resources. And so doing more to fund public defenders and to make sure that they have adequate time to do their jobs is one major step towards trying to correct the problems of poverty and racism in the criminal justice system.
You talk about exonerations, and you also, we said in the introduction, in the past 30 years alone, more than 2,800 innocent American prisoners have been exonerated and freed after being condemned for crimes they didn't commit. How prevalent is wrongful conviction even today?
Well, first of all, let me just point out that for every wrongful conviction, there's probably many wrongful prosecutions that never end up in convictions. You know, somebody gets indicted. The evidence should have never justified the indictment. They go to trial. A jury finds them not guilty, or a prosecutor at some point realizes that they ought to just dismiss the case. And so it never ends up in a prosecution or a conviction, but it still has upended that person's life. So I can't even begin to calculate how many of those there are that don't end up in convictions. But beyond that, I think it's fair to say that for every wrongful conviction, there are scores of people who are sitting in prison who have been wrongfully convicted, but who have not been exonerated. Why is that? Well, first of all, in order to be exonerated, generally, you need to have a lawyer who's going to be able to devote the time and energy and resources necessary to gather the evidence to exonerate you.
Right.
And once you're sitting in prison, it's pretty hard to find a lawyer, particularly on a pro bono basis, who's going to do that. And so the people who have been exonerated were fortunate enough to find a lawyer, you know, generally some sort of an innocence project at a law school, who were willing to take on their case. So that, again, sort of sets them apart as unusual. Then that lawyer needs to be able to have the fortune, good fortune, or perseverance to find evidence that supports the motion for a new trial or for exoneration. Again, at that stage, many people drop away because the lawyers just can't find the evidence. You know, a case is 30 years old, all the DNA is gone, or all the witnesses are dead. So people who are exonerated pass through that hurdle. And then, of course, once you have that, then you have to get past the judge, who is so focused on finality that the fact that there may be an injustice here is somehow less important than just putting this to rest. Enough is enough. We can't have these interminable appeals. So let's just deny this and let's all move on with our lives. So, you know, the people who have been exonerated have passed through each of those significant hurdles before being exonerated. So what does that tell us? It tells us that for every one of those people who were able to pass through those hurdles, there are a number of people, I can't tell you how many, but it's scores, who are in the same position, but just weren't able to pass all those hurdles.
I know this is not really the most important part of the book or the story of many of these people's cases, but you were able to obtain significant lawsuit settlements for some of these people that were wrongfully convicted and imprisoned for more than 25 years. You have, I think, 37 years. So can you just tell us the end with an example of, again, it's not a happy ending, but it's an ending where at least they were given some compensation for the years in prison?
Well, yeah, I'm happy to do that, but with this caveat. I mean, this book is not about, you know, me as a lawyer. It's not one of these, you know, I'm a great lawyer books. It's a book about the problems in the system and the impact that those problems have on everyday people. So I just want to make that clear.
Right.
I will also make clear that money is, it doesn't begin to compensate these people. So, you know, for somebody like Tim Bridges, who spent 25 years in prison for a rape and murder that he didn't commit, from the age of about 22 to the age of 47, he was in prison. He was sexually assaulted in prison. He would put himself into solitary confinement just to protect himself. And finally, he was exonerated by the Innocence Commission, found to be actually innocent. And we were able to negotiate a very large settlement from the city of Charlotte because their police officers had engaged in misconduct. But that, you know, all that did was to enable him to begin to put together his life. But he's beginning to put it together at age 50.
Yeah.
And you know, we can't make up for those 26 years in the prime of his life that he lost. He can't have kids anymore. He doesn't have grandchildren. You know, family members died while he was in prison. He couldn't go to their funerals. He couldn't say goodbye to his mom, who he loved dearly. You know, you can't compensate people for that. The best you can do is money. And it's a poor substitute. And frankly, it's not going to deter this kind of conduct going forward, because the people who actually engage in that conduct, they don't have the money to pay, and they're not responsible for the damages that are awarded. So, you know, from my perspective, I think it's important to pursue that, because otherwise these people can't get jobs, they can't get housing, they can't do anything in their lives. They have a 26-year hole in their resume.
Yeah.
What are they going to do? So it's important work, don't get me wrong, but I don't take any gratitude from that. It's just the best we can do.
Yeah, and it's also dramatic when I reviewed the Netflix series, The Staircase, that you also say that you just said, look at Michael Peterson, how much he's aged well beyond that physical years in prison. How much he has dramatically aged.
It was, I was shocked, Dan. I hadn't seen Michael in a number of years, you know, probably 4 or 5. We corresponded, we spoke on the phone, but I hadn't had a chance since I had moved away a couple of hundred miles from where he was in prison to visit him. And so when we got ready to do the hearing, they brought him to Durham, and it was shocking how much he had aged in those 8 years. And if you watch The Staircase, you can see it yourself between episode 8, when he's convicted, and episode 9, when he's brought back for his post-conviction hearing. It is shocking to see. And then after that, I won't spoil the series for anybody. You can see him sort of begin to get back to his old self again.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you so much, David Rudolph, for coming on and talking about your new book, American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. I know this is an audio book, and it's an ebook and paperback as of today for the release. So this interview will be posted tomorrow. So the book has just been released today. Thank you so much for this interview, American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. David Rudolph, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Dan. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's MIRO.com.